Good morning. I'm going to read two scriptures this morning. The first is 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. It's a trustworthy statement if any man aspires to the office of overseer. It's a fine work he desires to do. An overseer, then, must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceful, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert, so that he will not be conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And he must have a good reputation with those outside the church, so that he will not fall into a reproach and the snare of the devil. The second scripture I'm going to read is Titus chapter 1, verses 5 through 9, concerning the qualifications of an elder. For this reason I left you in Crete, that you would set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you. Namely, if any man is above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. For the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, not fond of sordid gain, but hospitable, loving, what is good, sensible, just, devout, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able to both exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Good morning. How is everybody today? Allergies, I hear. A few coughs along the way, so others agree with you. Regardless, I'm thankful that you're here today. We're blessed by you being here with us, whether it's your first time or you've been here more times than you can count, whether you are visiting with us or a member, we're thankful for your presence this morning. We're in the midst of a sermon series about leadership, specifically spiritual leadership and leadership for congregations, as we are on this this desire and this path to raise up new elders here at West University Church of Christ. And so we are just kind of working through a lot of what does the Bible say about leaders? What does that mean? Why is it important? And what kind of men are we looking for to become specifically elders of our congregation? But also, what are some of the qualities and characteristics that we can all aspire to? And so we're going to be looking at some of that. We have been for the past month or so, and we'll continue doing that for another month or so more. Leadership, at its most basic definition, is a relationship of influence. A relationship of influence in which one person seeks to influence the vision, values, attitudes, and behaviors of another. That's it. That's what leadership is in general. And leadership is often based on things like these inherent traits of charisma, or ability, or attractiveness, or availability. Often leaders are those who look like leaders, present themselves as leaders, and influence people like leaders. But what is it that makes a great leader? What are the characteristics and qualities that determine one's leadership ability and potential? According to Inc. magazine, great leaders are those who possess specific qualities like awareness, those who can keep an overall perspective of what's going on within their organization, or decisiveness, accountability, confidence, optimism, focus, and inspiration. Entrepreneur magazine and a similar article list many of those same traits, but also adds a few others like passion and innovation, stoicism, decisiveness, persistence, communication, and restlessness, a desire to always improve and innovate new solutions. Great leaders are those who are able to lead and facilitate change within their organization. And great leaders are those who are able to unite people towards a common goal or mission or task. And those who are perceived as great leaders are those who look the part and are able to speak clearly and convincingly about their point of view, persuading others to join them in their cause. And that is how many have defined leadership. And this week I Googled the phrase greatest leaders of the 20th century, and I came up with a pretty incredible list. On one hand, I had names like Winston Churchill and Martin Luther King Jr. and Mahatma Gandhi and Nelson Mandela and JFK, all people who were leaders of their population, whatever that might be, moving them towards a specific task or goal. And on the other hand, I also got a list that included Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Chairman Mao Zedong. Because when you take leadership traits at their face value, you can find all sorts of leaders throughout history who would fit that bill. I mean, Hitler was decisive and aware and confident of what he was able to do and persistent and innovative and restless and passionate. Mao was relentless. Stalin was focused and inspired. These leadership qualities that are so valued in corporate and governmental life aren't necessarily positive or negative, are they? They simply are. Because leadership, when you boil it down, is really all about influence. It's about bringing people around to your specific position or your point of view to accomplish a specific goal or task. And that task might be growing your company's earnings while promoting overall well-being for your employees and its market, or it could be the systematic extermination of an entire race of people. Depends on what you call a good leader. Which is what has led many in the 21st century to argue that leadership studies is actually on the decline. Now, you'd be hard-pressed to believe that if you were to peruse the local Barnes & Noble or walk through the airport bookstore. You can't turn without finding a book on leadership, representing different genres and points of view and places where leadership can play out. And leadership seminars and consultants are a $50 billion a year industry. It would be hard for us to argue that leadership is on the decline, but many who study leadership, who talk about it and teach it in universities, argue that based on how leadership is perceived, this discussion might actually be over. And we can trace that back to the early 1960s, which gave us a bumper sticker that summarized the feeling that many have about leadership today very well. That bumper sticker was, "Question authority." Does anybody know that bumper sticker? Do you recognize it? How many of you have it on your car? Okay, that's all right, either way. But it represented the angst that many people felt in light of what was happening in the world around them, from the civil rights movement to the Vietnam War and other things. And that statement, "question authority," is actually far older. It actually comes from a writing of Benjamin Franklin, who stated, "It is the first responsibility of every citizen to question authority." We just happened to boil it down in the 60s to a bumper sticker. Question all authority. In a book written just about 18 months ago, Harvard professor Barbara Kellerman argued that leadership is dead, or at least at an end. Kellerman writes that in the past we believed in people we called hero leaders, those who seemed larger than life and who we thought could accomplish anything and be in control and be poised in the midst of anything going on. And we believed in those heroes, leaders, that they would be upright and they would be just and they could accomplish anything they set their minds to. And Kellerman then writes, that perception is gone. That definition of leadership is at an end. Not only now have we come to question authority, but we've actually arrived at a point where we reject anyone who might claim to have any sort of authority. We have a fundamental crisis of leadership, Kellerman argues. And she goes on to say in the midst of that book that that might be a good thing because it's causing us then to look for a new kind of leader. One who breaks out of these expectations and these old understandings of what leadership is. They go past the norms and look to a bold new future. But it might also mean that in the midst of this crisis, we've given up on the possibility of true leadership at all. And we can only hope that these new leaders might emerge with right character and innovative vision and aspiring ability to chart a course forward. But until we find that individual, we're going to question authority. And we're in the midst of a crisis of leadership. Over the course of his three missionary journeys, Paul helped establish churches throughout the Roman Empire. He traveled all of the time and in all sorts of places, but he especially spent time in places like Crete and Asia Minor, today what we would call Turkey and Syria and even parts of Iraq, and Macedonia and Greece. And although Paul was a church planter at heart, he also had a desire for these churches that he planted to grow and develop over time. And Paul himself wasn't very good at that side of things, at least in person, because he would always travel from place to place, establishing new congregations and sharing the good news. But he would keep up correspondence with the churches he had left behind and helped establish. And he would often, because he had a heart for those churches, send his friends and associates back to help coach and guide these churches, helping them grow and continue to develop. And two of Paul's letters, at least in part, are written with questions of leadership on the mind. Paul writes these two letters to two of his associates, men who have traveled and ministered with him throughout all of his journeys. He had sent Timothy back to Ephesus to help minister to the churches that were there. And he sent Titus to the churches on Crete with the express purpose of helping raise up elders and overseers for the congregation there. And Paul's letter to Titus concerns church life and ecclesiology and also leadership. What does it mean to be the church and to lead the church? And it's in those two books that we'll be dwelling for these next few weeks as we talk about spiritual leadership. And in 1 Timothy, we see a true crisis of leadership. Many scholars and theologians believe that the Ephesian church has suffered under a wave of false teachers and promoters of false doctrine. And in Acts 20, Paul had warned the Ephesian elders that they were to be on their guard because savage wolves were going to come from both inside and outside of the church to attack and kill the flock. And it seems in between the time when Paul meets with those elders and when he sends Timothy back, that very thing has happened. And that kind of attack is enough to make the most diligent, devoted, and godly leader feel worn down and discouraged. So it's possible that at the time that 1 Timothy is being written, no one wanted to serve as leaders of the congregations in Ephesus. It's a difficult task because it's a difficult calling, and it comes with a lot of baggage and fear and angst and responsibility. The Ephesian churches were suffering from a crisis of leadership, one that Paul hoped to address through the presence of Timothy and this letter about admonition of leadership. And so here is what Paul writes in the middle of this letter as he wants to tell them about leadership. Here is a trustworthy saying. Whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. Paul talks about leadership as something that is noble. It's literally a good work. Spiritual leadership isn't a necessary evil or a task that's to be undertaken begrudgingly by individuals, but instead it is something of high regard. It is noble, worthwhile, and worthy. Because Paul wants us to know that spiritual leadership is a blessing to the community of faith, to the glory of God. And this noble task doesn't just need people who feature the things that Inc. and Entrepreneur magazine says are important, things like being passionate or decisive or confident, focused, and persistent, because there's more to leadership than just those characteristics. For Paul, true spiritual leadership is about character. And Paul goes on to lay out qualities and characteristics that he is looking for in a leader, the things that David read for us this morning. Listen to Paul's words again. Now the overseer is to be above reproach, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent, but gentle. not quarrelsome and not a lover of money. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him, and he must do so in a manner of worthy of full respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he might become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. And he must also have a good reputation with outsiders, so he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. Paul tells us here that he is looking for people of respectable character, people of integrity whose whole lives demonstrate their faith in God and faithfulness to his calling. And Paul lists out these characteristics that apply to the whole of life. And we're going to break them down into three distinct sections this morning, but they really cover the gambit of what life is called to be about. First, Paul calls us to some personal qualities and characteristics. Leaders have to have a desire to serve and lead in the church. Paul says they have to be able to teach, whether formally or, I would argue, more importantly, informally, through personal interaction with those around them. Able to teach means that they take seriously the calling to discipleship, to helping people grow in faith and maturity in Christ. And in order to do that, Paul says they shouldn't be a recent convert to faith. They need to have had time to grow in what they believe, allowing God to work in them and transform them to become more like Him through time spent in prayer and in reading and in communion with God and with devotion to Him. These are some of the personal qualities and characteristics that Paul wants to promote in potential spiritual leaders in those congregations. And second, Paul talks about moral qualities and characteristics that he's looking for, because he wants spiritual leaders to be people that others can admire, that others can admire in the way that they live and love. And so Paul says these leaders are to be above reproach. Not perfect by any means, but with no suspicion of a deeply flawed character that they keep hidden that no one else can see. These are people who live out faith every day, life. Spiritual leaders are those who aren't addicted or who aren't drinking to drunkenness. Instead, they practice self-control in every area of their lives. They aren't violent or quarrelsome. In Titus, Paul also adds that they aren't quick-tempered or overbearing. But instead, these spiritual leaders are meant to be temperate and gentle. They don't make hasty, or rash decisions, unwise decisions or responses. They think before they speak and act. These leaders aren't to pursue money above all else. Instead, they make godliness their priority in life. Spiritual leaders are those who practice contentment. In Titus, Paul also says that spiritual leaders are to be upright and disciplined and holy. Their lives are to be a reflection of what they believe. And he says they're to be hospitable, inviting others to participate in life with them. And Paul's instructions to Titus also throws in one little phrase that I find so compelling as he writes this. Rather, he must be hospitable, one who loves what is good. And I love Paul's wording here. It isn't just one who is good, or one who is trying to be good, or one who acts good. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But he says, one who loves what is good. That's a proactive and purposeful pursuit of godliness and goodness in life. It's the loving, active pursuit of what is best. And Paul says, I want people to be this way, not because it's going to make them better people, or not because it's going to help them earn their salvation, not for any of those reasons, but I want leaders to be this way because character counts. And the way that we live is meant to be an inspiration to others. Charles Spurgeon was a minister in England in the 19th century. And when he was asked about leadership, Spurgeon wrote, "A good character is the best tombstone. Those who have loved you, who loved you and were helped by you, will remember you when the forget-me-nots have withered. Carve your name on hearts and not on marble." Spurgeon saying the things that matter most in life are the lives we've touched and the people we've influenced for good, because character counts. And third, Paul argues the familial qualities of a spiritual leader are incredibly important. Paul says they are to be the husband of one wife, and literally in Greek, the phrase is simply a one-woman man. And there's all sorts of arguments and discussions and literature about what that means and how we translate it. But essentially, Paul is calling us to faithfulness. He's calling us to faithfulness. It's a reminder that marriage takes work, and it's tough. Faithfulness takes forgiveness, and selflessness when you'd rather be selfish, and forgiveness when you feel wronged, and openness and vulnerability to share. It takes a willingness to put another person's needs first, and the ability to listen, to care, and to love, even on days when you don't necessarily feel like it. And Paul states that an elder must be one who has learned how to live and love his wife with faithfulness and fidelity. Eugene Peterson is a writer and pastoral theologian who also served in congregational ministry for about 30 years. And in the midst of an interview, he was asked, "What's the most radical thing a Christian could do in the 21st century?" And Peterson responded this way, "Be in one faithful, loving, monogamous relationship your entire life." That's the most radical thing we can do in the 21st century for those who are married. In an age in which marriage seems to be more and more blasé, from starter marriages to infidelity to rampant divorces, this statement seems incredibly difficult and challenging. And I want to say this morning that this isn't meant to be an indictment on anyone who has been divorced. And this isn't me or Paul saying you have to stay with the spouse and suffer abuse. And this isn't meant to be a catch-all for every situation and possibility, but it is a reminder that this type of faithfulness is incredible. And fidelity, being committed to something or someone for the long haul, is a very important aspect of leadership. And so, Paul says, be faithful. And he also states that they must lead their family well. And the language here, again, is kind of tough, because the Greek actually says he must keep his children submissive. And if you were watching me this morning, that doesn't work in my family either. And that the NIV softens it quite a bit as we translate it when we say he must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him. The message takes it even a step further, making it easier. He must handle his own affairs well, attentive to his own children and having their respect. And we have to keep in mind that Paul here is writing to his own culture and his own time. He has in mind the Roman household and the idea of the paterfamilias, a father, the oldest male in the family, who has complete authority over his family and total control over everyone associated with him. And so in the midst of that, Paul is saying, how well does this person fulfill that role in their culture? How well does he handle the people he has responsibility over? Because that says something about their leadership potential. And it is an encouragement to look at a potential leader's family. How does his family view him? Do they respect him or do they fear him? Is he heavy-handed or domineering in the way he reacts with them? Or does he lead with love? Does he encourage and promote faith, as the letter to Titus asks when it talks about, do his children believe? Is this a man whose faith has transformed every aspect of his life? Another way to talk about everything that Paul has been talking about in this letter, the personal and the moral and the familial qualities of a leader, is using vocabulary from organizational management. Does this individual have relational congruence? Now, that's a big word. But it simply asks this, are they the same person in every circumstance, relationship, and situation in life? Are they people who practice what they preach? Is this a person who has integrity of character and lives out their faith in their life? Do the relationships in their life demonstrate faith and faithfulness, care and consistency? Do they keep promises to God and to others? Are these potential leaders those who express themselves and their identity and values in spiritually and emotionally healthy ways? Is this a person who is respected by those both inside and outside of the congregation for the way that they live and love? Spiritual leaders need to be those who are respectable and above reproach. They must have consistency and constancy, and that doesn't mean that they have to be perfect. And it doesn't mean that they have to be powerful, and it doesn't mean that they're the wealthiest or most influential people in the community, but they should be the most spiritually mature. And as we begin this process of cultivating new elders for our congregation, we want to choose people who are respected by our congregation. Individuals who are spiritually mature and maturing, and then leading others to do the same in their own lives. Elders who practice what they preach and teach as much through their words and through their lifestyle as they do in their own lifestyle. And next week we're going to talk about this nomination process and the steps we're going to go through, and we're going to kind of lay that out a little bit. But this week what I'd like for you to do as a congregation, as individuals, is to prayerfully consider who you think best fits these qualities of spiritual leaders from within our own congregation. Paul's words here are not just meant to be find leaders who are exactly this way. He is saying these are the qualities and characteristics, but he's also, in a way, saying these are all things that we are to shoot for and strive for. But really, the only way we can begin to live these things out in our own lives is to make Jesus the Lord of our life. If we're not following Christ, then none of the rest of that stuff matters. It doesn't. It's all nice and well and good. But without Christ, all the other things are meaningless. And what we're looking for in this congregation are people, are leaders who have made Jesus the Lord of their life. But what we really want is a congregation of people who have made Jesus the Lord of their life. And Jesus says, anyone who wants to come, come. Come and I will give you rest. Jesus wants to be the leader and Lord of your life. This morning we're going to offer a public time of invitation. If there's anything we can pray for you today, or if you just say, I want to know more about this one that you claim faith in, or you say, I want to put Christ on in baptism and make him the Lord of my life, or anything else, we want to offer this time of invitation. Or you're welcome to see us after and discuss life and faith and things that are going on. But if there's a way we can help you this morning, feel free to respond publicly. But regardless, let's sing out with joy and hope and love because we have Jesus who is the Lord of our life. Let's sing together. Jesus.